Welcome back, everyone, to Red Spotlight. I'm your host, Alexis Soto, and I'm joined this week by myself. I just wanted to do a little solo show for you guys just to, you know, catch all us up on what is the happenings and going-ons here at our podcast. This is Red Spotlight, the place that talks about all the things going on in the world of movies and more. And just to give you a brief programming note about, like, what we've been doing lately, so these last few weeks, in fact, it's felt like six at this point, we've been doing a lot of reviews and reactions on Ahsoka, the Star Wars TV show, and you can find all of those reactions, and believe me, they're quite long, on our YouTube page. And then we've also been doing, I think, just like, you know, the podcast, and we've had the time to do so. The last episode we did, which was 457, we kind of went into like all the details as to like what we've been doing, why we've been doing that, and then also how come there's been a bit of a lag when it comes to the content that's coming out. But yeah, that's kind of where things are at, and unfortunately we're also in a space where like we're really kind of busy, and it's kind of, you know, it's sad because like there's actually a lot of things that we could be diving into that's not just the news. You know, right now I've been, you know, taking a deep dive into Studio Ghibli films, particularly the ones that were directed by Miyazaki, in preparation for The Boy and the Heron. At the same time, I'm also watching some Scorsese films that I hadn't had the chance to see, like After Hours and The Color of Money and others, in preparation for his new film that'll be out later this year, which is Killers of the Flower Moon. And just getting ready for the awards season and to see all these wonderful movies, because quite frankly, and you know, I'm not sure if I did a good enough job of communicating this last podcast, but like, it really has been like week after week after week of just like the most uninteresting looking films. And I'm not even saying that they're the worst or that they're awful, but for the most part, none of them certainly weren't very good. Maybe one or two had some interesting responses, but just generally speaking, no one here on our channel had any interest in watching any of these. And at this moment, I'm just going to go ahead and give them the justice they deserve in being, you know, mentioned. But I guess certainly Gran Turismo was one of those that we were burned on, because not only was the concept of it not very interesting, but the trailer really overplayed and wore out its welcome at our theater. So no, we generally had no interest in that. The same would be said for The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which looked moderately interesting, but again, I feel like no matter what we think of or feel of a particular film or project, if there is enough word coming out that is favorable or interesting, and not, I don't mean from anybody, but from specific voices, that would usually drive us to go and see it. And, this film certainly did not inspire much goodwill. Okay, well, what else came out? Expendables 4, no thank you. Equalizer 3, no thank you at all. Which really at the end of the day just sounds like the exact same film. You also had movies like, see, I'm even forgetting right now what else even came out because it just wasn't very noteworthy. Give me 1 second. So the overall point is these things just were so boring and uninteresting that there was just no point. So it doesn't mean that I should stop watching new things. And so that's why I went out of my way to go watch something good for a change, which was the Miyazaki movies, which have been definitely giving me my fix. See, there's even a Paw Patrol film, no thank you. A new Saw movie, get out of here. Dumb Money, which is just fucking, what's his name? Adam McKay Light, fuck off. The Nun 2, was received better than the Nun 1, but still on the whole very negative. And it's like, well, I don't need that. Bye. A Haunting in Venice, which is a Kenneth Branagh film. I don't like Kenneth Branagh's movies, so... And it also was received hilariously better than the previous films, but still not interesting. Didn't do it. There's a film called... Wow, they already played. Well, that's about it, generally speaking. The last one that we saw together that was new was the Mutant Mayhem film, which was a long time ago at this point. So yeah, but that doesn't mean that I haven't been seeing anything new. And if you go back to last week's show, there were a number of films that I gave little reviews on, and I hope to talk about again whenever we have more people back on. I especially look forward to hearing Peter's reaction to both El Conde and Past Lives, both films that I think not only would I, you know, recommend them both, but especially in the case of Past Lives, that is a truly special movie that I think will resonate deeply with a lot of people. And so that's definitely one. It's from A24, so I would strongly advise people to go check that one out. And it's also one of the great films that is even made better by the fact of just going in cold and not having really any kind of expectations to ruin it. So that's what I would say. So as to what I saw this week, well, this week was actually my first time going back and seeing a new movie in theaters, because I had seen Porco Rosso, Princess Mononoke, in theaters. Oh, and Jurassic Park. And I'm not even sure I talked about that. Yeah, you know what? I'll start off with that one first. So a few weeks ago, I actually went to go see Jurassic Park on the big screen, which, I mean, I had to. At this point, I would love the opportunity. I mean, we out go and see these like old films in theaters anyway, right? But particularly with Spielberg, I mean, in the last year I saw E.T. and Jaws. And then you can also extend that also to Fablemans and West Side Story. So I feel like whenever there's like a movie that I obviously love, like Jurassic Park, I really need to go and see it. And I'm still really just not over the fact that, and again, kind of like how we're at right now, where Peter and Kyle are just so freaking busy. And by the way, to be fair, so am I. But I was just so heartbroken that earlier this year we couldn't go and see Return of the Jedi, which is still a film I've yet to see in a big screen alongside the original A New Hope and then also Empire Strikes Back. But it was a good watch. It was a good experience. And again, it's like just watching the film for the first time again, it plays just as well. Again, if you're going to go out and watch this, you've already seen this film so many times. And the only thing I will say is I think some people certainly dragged their uninterested children and they were just going up and down the stairs throughout the film. And yeah, at that point, I'm sorry, but like, just wait outside and be on TikTok if that's how you're going to be. Just get the fuck out of there. The one person I think had to take out his little kid because he was crying. I think this is after the Tyrannosaurus Rex broke out, so that's understandable. Then also proves how effective this film can still be. And that was also my first time watching it in 3D, which is not certainly by choice. It was just the only way I could actually see it. And you know what? It actually was pretty good, and has just been yet another movie that I had to see in 3D that I thought, you know what, in some way really enhanced it. Earlier this year, I mentioned that I saw Titanic in 3D, and I felt that was just an amazing, you know, viewing experience for sure. So yeah, I went to go see that. And then, so what I had mentioned to prior to this was that I had seen a new movie for the first time in theaters since early August, I want to say. Certainly since Blue Beetle, I think. And the last ones were Mutant Mayhem and then Blue Beetle, both of which I think, on the whole, we had favorable things to say. I think, as you know, I had more time to think about it. Blue Beetle certainly just falls by the wayside almost completely, except for the fact that it has a really unique and funny family dynamic that carries the whole thing that I, for me, at the end of the day, makes it worth watching. But the stuff that's there is just so generic and forgettable that I'm like, yawn. And then Mutant Mayhem is very good, certainly. I just feel like the more removed I am from it, the more I'm finding the film didn't really resonate. It didn't really click in that I'm not thinking about it like ever. And there was just, it didn't necessarily hit me in the feels that I thought that it would. And it's not fair to really have that be a standard that it has to cross, because it just isn't fair for it to do that. So that's just my personal expectations getting in the way of it. So, but both films certainly, I thought, got a favorable reaction from us. Speaking of which, I just thought it was hilarious, in the most fucked up way imaginable. And I'm going to use this moment to actually talk about it, because I just was just... So, if you remember in the press junket, that at that point, I believe they had to pre-film in advance before the actors went on strike. But certainly months and weeks before the film even came out, the cast of Blue Beetle were really going out of their way to... communicate ineffectively that they had been given that James Gunn had given them his word that their film and their characters would be the first like official step into his DC film extended universe. And the thing is, and I'm sure they themselves knew this as well, but I think they were just, they were told to say that as a means to market the film. But if you have like half a brain, you really know at this point that, considering all the other stories that had been coming out, like a month ago, we were talking about how Gal Gadot was saying that she was given assurances that she would be involved in a future Wonder Woman project under James Gunn's stewardship. And the reality, and then of course, when you couple that in with David Ayer trying to get his Ayer cut of Suicide Squad released, it brings to mind a couple of things. The Warner Brothers executives and all of the people who have, the Warner Brothers executives themselves made an endless, seemingly unlimited number of mistakes when it came to their DC films. And it just seemed like it's not just that they royally screwed over literally all of their talent, but it also just feels like, man, they really picked some of the most annoying people to work with. And that sounds harsh, especially because they had a lot of these, this talent, whether it be the writers, the directors, or the actors, really received no support from Warner Brothers the entire step of the way. So it's not really fair to single them out. But at the same time, I don't understand what this whole last year has really done for them. Because while I can say that fans and people who are covering DC are already like dismissing what hasn't even been made yet in the new iteration of the DC universe, and it just seems to me that either they should have delayed James Gunn's hiring an announcement after these 2023 DC films had been released, or they should have just announced, or they could have announced it, but then also just say nothing else about it. until these films had been released. Now, to give them a little bit of fairness, who could have predicted that DC comic book blockbuster films would do this poorly? Now, it's a bit of a double-edged sword because no DC film outside of Joker and Batman has been profitable since 2019's Shazam. So there have been plenty of telltale signs that the bottom was about to fall out from underneath it, but no one thought to this extent. But then again, and you can also argue that the really poor track record of DC films contributed to this factor, but I very much am of the belief that we're in a paradigm shift, and when you couple DC's poor track record of films alongside Marvel's recent poor track record, alongside just generally speaking blasé, run of the road, just ugly looking blockbuster films of all stripes, I think this year has really shown us that that's just not something that audiences are going to accept any longer unless it's truly exceptional or worthy of their time. And when you put all those things together, that's ultimately what's resulted in just the complete collapse of the DC universe. And especially in the performances of these films. But more to the point, James Gunn, I feel like he was just doing the best he could to be a people pleaser, but it's really done him no favors to have been nice to these people, because all they're doing is just making him look worse and worse and worse with every passing week, because he's just coming off like a liar. And he was, from all appearances, lying to them. And I'm not even saying that's wrong. I feel like a lot of these people definitely are a bit of a prima donna mentality. Certainly, I'm sure Gal Gadot and David Ayer fit that description. And you can definitely say that most of all to Henry Cavill. But at least he was given the decency to be told he was no longer invited to the party. But I don't understand. I want to say the only way that these people, the only reason why they were so misinformed about what their future involvement would look like was to avoid any kind of litigation and to allow contracts to expire, or because they genuinely, the studio didn't want to alienate them to the point where they could no longer work with them in other projects not related to DC in the future. So, but they really played this wrong, and you know, I can't entirely say that I blame the talent for just saying these things in the trades, because they had already been burned, and it's seemingly not going to end there. So they just chose for themselves that, hey, you know what? What more can they do to me? I already lost this gig. I'm not going to get it back. So here's something that'll just get my name out there, and you know, we'll let the chips fall where they may. And so what did James Gunn say this week? Well, he was asked about the canon question again. He basically just said that the first official canon story in his DC universe would be I think the Creature Commandos animated series, and then Superman Legacy, which is a complete about face as to like what supposedly, not just, and to be fair, I don't think it was just the cast of Blue Beetle who was parroting this idea. I want to say that James Gunn himself at one point said, either through social media or out of his own mouth, that Blue Beetle would be the first installment. And guess what? It bombed. It did terribly, as expected. And that no longer seems to be the case, because this statement just says, Blue Beetle who? Yeah. That's pretty much what we thought the case would be. And as I said in the past, I feel really bad for the cast of Blue Beetle that they were kind of like strung along like this. And I feel even more bad about the fact that no one cared about their movie. I am especially sympathetic because, you know, I understand that that's a very tight-knit community. I belong to that community. And we always try and support each other's projects and they come out and it just really came out at the worst possible moment. Especially when like no, at that point the actors can't promote anything. So it's like, well, the one vestige remaining that they could have used to alert people as to their existence was just not available to them because of the ongoing strikes. So yeah, that was a whole situation, which I thought was just, oh my goodness, just more DC drama. But at the same time, I do want to push back on this idea that, that this whole thing is doomed and damaged beyond repair to an extent. I think ultimately what's going to change it is making good movies. And as we've seen with Across the Spider-Verse and Guardians 3, well, if you put out something truly exceptional, people are going to come out and see it. And I can't imagine a Superman film. Well, let me put it to you this way. I can't imagine in this particular era a James Gunn directed superhero project that is not anything less than great. The Guardians movies, Suicide Squad, and Peacemaker. I mean, all that stuff is in a league of its own. Truly. And I can't imagine a James Gunn directed Superman movie being anything less than great. And it's going to be James Gunn, and it's going to be a different kind of Superman film. But it just seems that people don't want that. They're not interested in what his version of Superman would be. And that, of course, just speaks to this overall fan entitlement of like, you can't change Superman. You can't change who he is. And it's a bit presumptuous of you to say that he is. But it is also just very limiting to say that he couldn't, you know, alter some things or, you know, bring his own whole energy and vibe into it. So, yeah, all it does is it just raises the stakes on him to deliver a great movie and shut them up. But it's like, it's so far away. It's like, we're not going to get that film until 2025. Which, on the other hand, is also very good because considering how disastrous the DC films have performed this year, a break is more than needed. Because it's very clear that audiences, more so than just, you know, normal superhero blockbuster Marvel fatigue, they do not care about these movies from DC. Warner Brothers, they do not care about those characters. They never really have. And at this point, it's just like, get it out of my face bad how audiences have rejected those films. That was a lot right there. Definitely a lot of preamble. But all of that was just to get to like, well, what was the movie that I saw in theaters this week? Well, it's interesting because the movie that I saw in theaters actually happens to be by Gareth Edwards. And Gareth Edwards, I know a lot about, but I can't speak to the films that he's made personally. I never saw his Godzilla movie because, and this might get me in trouble, but you know what? Hey, we all have things that we like and we all have things that we just don't really care for. I am not a Godzilla fan in that the concept of the story is just not something that gets me to care about anything. Kaiju films also, with the exception of Del Toro's brilliant Pacific Rim, don't really get me to care. Really at all about anything. So yeah, I didn't see Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, though I've heard quite a bit about it. I didn't see his movie Monster, but I did see, of course, Rogue One. Who hasn't? And that has always kind of been a bit of a asterisk, whether that was more his film or it was more Tony Gilroy's movie. And I have to say that you have to look at the projects of both of those creatives following Rogue One to really get a good idea as to like whose movie it was more, I guess, if anyone really cares. But Tony Gilroy's follow-up was Andor, the Disney Plus series, which was phenomenal, truly. Nothing short of perfect. And nothing is perfect, by the way. And I thought that was pretty much perfect. And then Gareth Edwards' follow-up is this, which is certainly anything but. And I feel like I know my answer as to like whose movie Rogue One belonged more to based on these follow-up projects. And I feel pretty strongly in that that's going to really run counter to a lot of others' feelings on Rogue One entirely. I feel like Rogue One is certainly more than just a general, deeply flawed film. I think it really suffers from a lack of interesting characterization, some of the worst editing and pacing I've seen in a film of that scale. And it's just generally disengaging until it ends up being engaging. And of course, that third act is pretty amazing. No one denies that. No one ever should deny that. It was an amazing third act. So, yeah, it seems like that was more Gareth's movie, even though he didn't necessarily get final cut and Tony Gilroy was brought in to do it over again. But I don't know how much Tony Gilroy could have really done. And we'll never really know, I guess, the specifics of what happened in that situation. But we can only do, all we can do is just move forward, do what we have now. And Gareth Edwards' new project is called The Creator. I'll get to the synopsis in just a bit. It's certainly not very interesting. It certainly is a story that you've seen before, in much more interesting variations in the past. So that's something of an opening salvo. But one of the biggest compliments I can give this film is that it is it's a studio movie, some 20th Century Studios, formerly Fox. And it certainly sports a considerable VFX, budget in the way that it used to be, because when you watch the film, it looks very good. And there are a lot of VFX shots where it's like, wow, that looks great. And you're just so used to that not being the case because, especially when you look at the other films that are, you know, greenlit by Disney or Warner Brothers, films that look like this usually run up in the hundreds of millions of dollars. This is only $80 million. And it again just goes to show you that there's just no excuse for the budgets of all those other shows and movies that Disney has, particularly with Marvel running up the numbers that it does from a budget standpoint. There's just no excuse, because this looks great. And I can tell you that this is most assuredly receiving a nomination for Best Visual Effects and might very well be in the running to win. There's something really interesting happening right now with that race where we may not see a Best Picture nominee in the race. That all depends if Oppenheimer is eligible or not to even run. And even if it was eligible or not, recall that the people in that guild have this mentality that if they can't see the CGI, or if it's not a CGI heavy visual effects, presentation. They're not necessarily going to go with it. And of course, if you know the history, Oppenheimer, Nolan was saying this loud and clear that there really wasn't any CG, you know, involved in the movie. So that might have, he might have eliminated himself from consideration. Not that it should have, but considering how these people work at the Academy and how that branch works particularly, he may have just done that. And so it leaves a wide open race for what visual effects winner might emerge. And I can certainly say that creator might be one of those, but I can't be certain of it considering I don't believe this film is going to really resonate beyond just it being in the talk of this week because it's the big release of this week. But it shouldn't diminish how great the movie looks. That being said, let's look at this story. I have to say though, I wasn't very interested in the trailers. I think the trailers looked like exactly the film that I got, and it's not good because the trailers just made me go, I've seen this, I don't care. Anyway, this is a fight for our very existence. This is from Letterboxd. Amid a future war between the human race and the forces of artificial intelligence, Joshua, a hardened ex-special forces agent, grieving the disappearance of his wife, is recruited to hunt down and kill the creator, the elusive architect of advanced AI who has developed a mysterious weapon with the power to end the war and mankind itself. Anywho, it was fine. In moments, it was quite good. And it ultimately ended up being an experience that was very comparable to what Rogue One is, because most of the film, I would say, I was pretty bored with and not at all engaged. And I'm sorry to say, but for most of it, I was just kind of like, man, when is this going to be over? I'm kind of done here. And that might suggest that it's awful. It's really not. It's very standard. It's quite competent. And there's some interesting looking shots and camera movement that is indicative of a director that has something going on. But clearly that he doesn't have that same adeptness when it comes to storytelling or screenplay writing, because it just wasn't grabbing me. And then the third act happened and I'm like, where did that come from? Because the third act was actually pretty freaking good and thrilling and exciting in the way that made me think of Rogue One in that moment where it's like, wow, what the fuck? This is all of a sudden, they just like woke up and woke me up in the process too. I think John David Washington needs to take a step back and reevaluate the kind of projects he wants to be in, because aside from Black Klansman, everything else he's made, I don't feel he is suited for. And that isn't to say that he isn't capable of being in these films or that he isn't worthy of it. No, I'm not saying that at all. He's very capable and very good, but it's just not, he's not found his niche yet. This character who is supposed to be the lead here didn't click, didn't connect. There is a central romance of which the film's heart lies in it. It didn't click. It's not there for me. Another person who needs to have a serious talk with her agent about what the hell is going on with her career is Gemma Chan. Again, she's also somebody who I really like, but it's just another face in another film that I don't care about, and that's a problem. Allison Janney was good in this, a very unexpected performance from her. Ken Watanabe was not great, and I would have preferred to have seen something far better than what he got handed here. Madeline Unifoils, who is Alfie here, was probably the only great performance in the whole thing, and maybe the only reason to actually see this, because she is playing this child robot that you see in the trailers, and she was fantastic. So if there's any reason to see the film, it's because of her. But everything else is just like, well, visually in some spaces it's grabbing me, it's interesting, and then everything else from characterization is just not. So that's never a good mix. And then because I don't feel Edwards is that much of a writer, it struggles to really get out what it's trying to say. If it's even trying to say much of anything, which, well, science fiction usually almost does. And you get glimpses of it here, but you're not quite sure what the takeaway is, because the surprising thing about the film is that it actually lands on the side of being pro-artificial intelligence, which is very strange, especially the timing of its release, because we are in the thick of a massive pushback on artificial intelligence and fight against it. And I mean, for goodness sake, the writers just ended a strike in which one of the largest factors of was artificial intelligence. And for a film like this to come out and basically say AI is great is dangerous, I would say, and not very good to have that kind of thought be out there. At the same time, if you extrapolate that stuff out of it and then just look at the if you ignore our own reality and just look at the film, yes, it is to a large extent able to drum up sympathy for a lot of these machines because of how tyrannical and imperialistic our own government can become when it really wants to be. So, and of course, it's a whole thing of like how humans are bigger monsters than anything else than the monsters that we see ourselves. So in that way, yes, it's effective, but it's just a very confusing moment in our time for a film like this to be taking such a pro-AI stance. Especially because AI is the enemy so far. No one has really presented a good enough case for what pros AI has to offer, but it's definitely ruining a lot of things, and it's going to lead to exactly where we all think it's going to take us to. So there's that situation happening. Yeah, it's just not a very interesting movie, and the more I'm left sitting with it, the more I feel like I didn't really like it at all. Like, I think I walked out of it feeling kind of mixed, but really not caring about it, and now I'm like, yeah, I'll never see this again. So, that was that. I also wanted to talk about, you know, what's happening with awards and what's happening with the season. And, well, if you've been seeing, I want to say that the Golden Globes are still looking for a place to air their show. And they're trying really hard because they have really revamped their whole deal in ways that even a year ago, no one thought they would do. So they're no longer airing on NBC. The HFPA, which is the Hollywood, or was the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, is not a thing that exists anymore. It was a 90-something member organization, voting group. They supposedly added new diverse members last year. Then that got disbanded. Dick Clark Productions purchased the rights to the Globes. I believe Tim Grayson of Variety took over leadership of the Globes as far as like what decisions to make for the award show and how it would be presented. They hired some big wig Oscar veteran producers. And they've also announced some new categories. One of which I'm not going to discuss because it just seems so strange, which is like stand-up comedy, so I'm just going to ignore it. And the other thing isn't necessarily good either. And really, at the end of the day, just a ploy to get people's attention and to cause mischief and controversy, which is what I believe they feel they have to get people talking about them. Because, you know, you can... And I should have mentioned also that they expanded the voter base to more than 300 people. I think the categories themselves are also expanded to having 6 nominees each instead of 5. So, look, they're trying. They're trying their damnedest here to get their name out there and get some space. But you can't get rid of the trash altogether. You got to have that Globes trash in there because that's who they are. That's what their stamp is. And so I don't want that part of it to go away. And so what they've come up with is something they call the Best Box Office Achievement Award. And what's incredible is they're actually going to have 8 nominees, which is just like, okay, so they'll just take the top 8 movies that made the most money, and then those are your nominees. Which, if you're not aware of, in the past, the Oscars attempted something like this with what was supposed to be called the Best Popular Film category as a means to get more people's attention to watch the broadcast because people in general do not care about film anymore or the art form in film. They only care about films if there's action in it and if it's part of a longstanding franchise that they've had a connection with previously. So none of those films clearly were not going to get nominated because there were better films every year. But the populace doesn't care or doesn't know or whichever you like because they don't care to know or they don't know to care about what other, you know, superior movies may be out there. But no matter that, they feel if they nominate films that everybody has seen, that will get their attention to watch these shows, which they seem to think is important to do. One of the things is, well, we don't even know where the Globes yet are going to be, but it's looking increasingly unlikely that it'll be on TV. And you only really create a category like this if the calculation is to increase television ratings, and if it's not going to be on television, well, what is the point? I saw Joyce Ng from Gold Derby say that she thinks that, well, they'll probably announce it where they're going to air closer to December the 11th when they announce the nominees, but it may very well just be their YouTube page, which we'll see. And then maybe they'll do a good enough job where next year somebody will pick them up. But I feel like if you read between the lines, this may be their opportunity to get Barbie something. Because it seemed like when Barbie came out that, oh, it was a no-brainer. That it was just going to like steamroll a lot of the comedy musical categories at the Globes. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case, and the more I'm thinking about it and others are thinking about it, there is actually a lot of decent competition for Barbie. And that could come from The Holdovers, that could come from Poor Things, and that could very well come from The Color Purple. And the comedy musical category, I should be clear. Because in Best Picture and this award show, they split it off into drama and into comedy musical. And if there's a musical and it's a really good musical that sometimes can sway them. Both La La Land and West Side Story won here recently in that category in years past. So Barbie has musical elements. It has comedic elements, but it's not completely one or the other. Whereas Color Purple, which no one has seen, and no one is quite sure yet if it's still premiering this year, certainly seems like it's going to be like a really big musical with some really big performances that will also be nominated. So I feel like if that is the case, and if it's received very well, that bumps Barbie down to third place to win Best Picture Comedy Musical behind Color Purple and Poor Things from Yorgos Lanthimos and Emma Stone, which also stars Mark Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe, which looks absolutely amazing. So the more you think about it, the more you kind of, well, yeah, Barbie at the moment is one of the highest grossing films of the year. In fact, I'm pretty sure it is already the highest grossing movie of the year because I'm sure it passed Super Mario Brothers. So there you go. That's their way to have to recognize Barbie. And who knows if they'll even have it the next year. Who knows if there even will be a Globes the next year. But that's how I think. Because I feel Oppenheimer will clearly win drama. And when it comes to comedy musical, it'll be between Poor Things or Color Purple. And then Barbie will certainly win the Box Office Achievement Award. So there's that. And where that leaves us overall, well, I mean, it's too soon to even start prognosticating as to like how it's going to shape up. But certainly those films are definitely front runners. Oppenheimer, Poor Things, Barbie. I don't know of anything else that could win just yet, but it's very, very early on in the season and films are still, you know, getting picked up. And in the following weeks, you're going to be seeing a lot of those festival movies end up being either released theatrically or more likely be dumped on insert streaming service here. So the more the closer we get to that, the more we have to say on it. But the last thing I'll leave you guys with is Martin Scorsese. And I'll just go ahead and play the clip here from my phone because, you know, I did speak to this as a matter of fact in a little short video I released on the YouTube page. That really got me revved up, and I won't get too much into it here, but since then he was at a press conference, I believe, well, not a press conference, but he was at the premiere for his movie or one of the premieres or screening, and he was asked, and I think this is a far clearer way of getting to the heart of what he was saying in ways that it would be harder to misconstrue, but then again, you would definitely be surprised how far people will go to not hear the truth. Anyway, these are his words talking about, like, really at the end of the day, what he's concerned about is certain films just being pushed out and not given a chance as the bigger scale films with the bigger budgets are.
The thing about it is that it would be great to see not only blockbusters on a big screen and franchise films on a big screen, but also what they consider now indie films. And I don't like that title. I think that categorizes a film or pigeonholes it. I think they're films for everyone. And I would love to see a support in theaters, particularly, which would make it possible for people to want to come to a theater to see a film that isn't necessarily a blockbuster and needs a giant screen. Glad that it's on a giant screen. But otherwise, the theaters will only become for films that are action films. That's all I'm concerned about.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that, at least to me, that's what he was always saying, but a lot of people just refuse to engage with it, and a lot of people to this very day and this very week were just, like, spouting a whole bunch of nonsense that was just, like, pretty incredible to believe, if I'm being honest with you, how far certain people took it. and it honestly got me really upset because, like, this guy's not going to be around for too much longer, and people are just willfully, like, twisting his words and into this kind of, like, well, he's wrong and he's being silly and we should ignore him. And I'm like, what? Okay. It was just unusual to me. And let me just go ahead and read off some comments that David had said. What I love about this is that the dudes on the internet who talk about go woke, go broke stuff are always saying that films have been horrible these past couple of years. But when someone brings up an indie movie or anything that has a small audience, they'll say, oh, well, we're just talking about the mainstream media movies, basically a blockbuster. And that pisses me off. Like, you can't just make a big claim and then backtrack it when someone tries to prove you wrong. Blockbusters have the potential to be filmed just as great as Everything Everywhere, or as an Everything Everywhere All at Once, or what people probably consider cinema, and indie movies should be talked about just as much as blockbusters. If you want the blockbusters to get better and indie movies to be popular, you have to let studios know that you want to see different kinds of films. And then Peter responded with, I hate modern film. All blockbusters suck now. Him mocking these people. And then continuing, but also those are literally the only films I will ever watch, and I won't even look the way of a film. Look the way of a film made for less than $80 million. Quote, that's what he, mocking these people who he calls every shitty YouTuber everywhere, or every shitty movie YouTuber. And then David responds with, unless it gets talked about enough, like Everything Everywhere All at Once or Barbie, then they'll watch something different and pretend as if it's the last great movie they're going to see for a long time. And then they'll literally start complaining again afterwards, saying, now I have to go watch insert blockbuster, modern movies suck. I think that's a really good taste of, like, how shitty people can be when interacting with just indie films and dismissing them, but then also just how idiotic these people are generally about movies and just generally about, like, their own talking points. But I'm trying to find the clip here that I wanted to share with you, even though it's really not worth anybody's time. But here it is. And I just feel like it's, you know who it is. I'll just present this without comment. Here it is.
Bought some tickets for Killers of the Flower Moon, as I said, to see with my dad. We are still, a couple hours later, the only people in the theater. I did secure some IMAX tickets in case I wanted to see it on IMAX at AMC Lincoln Square, but I don't know if I want to sit for 4 hours in that theater, to be honest with you. I just don't know if I want to do that. But I bought tickets somewhere else, and it is, I mean, I'll check it again later, but still, only seats in the theater. So not great. So I think, you know, he shouldn't be setting himself up for this problem, and he shouldn't be comparing himself to Nolan, because I don't think he's going to make close to what Oppenheimer did. Hey, Bay, thank you for gifting a membership. I also think he's going to find himself in a complete poop storm of political conversation once this movie comes out. I think he's going to be attacked big time, or people might just ignore it. So I think he's going to have a very difficult time. So I guess this is the calm before the storm. So what he said today was that he wants to, that comic book movies need to be fought off. We have to fight off comic book movies, because if we're not, and he said that Nolan and the Safdie brothers were the people he would use as examples who were fighting off comic book movies. And you're like, Nolan? I think Scott Derrickson said, oh yes, the man who made a famous Batman trilogy. I mean, Nolan uses comic book movie language. That's what he uses to succeed. So he's totally borrowing from that playbook. So it's crazy to use him as an example. That's why his movie made $900 million+, because he did a comic book treatment of Oppenheimer. You know, very much so. Oppenheimer plays like a graphic novel. to a degree. And the Safdie brothers, I like them. I think they're very talented, but they're not exactly lighting the world on fire at the box office. So anyway.
And then I want to share the words I had to this clip first, and then I'm going to share with you a smaller, shorter clip that she was saying in regards to this. But I said, you really got to hand it to Grace. Every word of this is literally too stupid to be disingenuous. I don't know what she has against these legendary filmmakers, but similarly to her deranged attacks on Steven Spielberg's supposed lack of authority to speak on issues of divorce in his Fablemans movie, and Francis Ford Coppola's financial issues affecting his latest film earlier this year, here she is now belittling Martin Scorsese for nobody wanting to see his movie. She's literally making fun of him because his movie is not selling like a blockbuster, as if that doesn't help prove the point he's making. Literally every word of what she says in this video is just what happens when you're a slave to the box office, which honestly is what gives her license to just take below the belt shots at these legends because their films no longer make money. And then she says this.
I think he would get more out of seeing a comic book movie and saying he liked it and taking a picture of himself coming out of it like Tom Cruise does. I think he would do more to expand his fan base and get people to see Killers of the Flower Moon than this.
I think, yeah, that's awful. I said it was revolting. The idea that he would have to, do that is just so, he would basically just debase himself. And I'm not even saying that, he can't do that, but just the idea that he would need to do that to save his public image, it's just no, he doesn't have to do any of that. It's just people, in general, are being overly sensitive, and to me, they just lose all credibility, because you can tell, just me, Peter was and David were saying it better than ever I could, but they don't watch literally any other kind of movie. What they think all movies are action, science fiction, comic book, space movies. And I love those things as well. I don't think they should be the only kind of stories that should exist. And that's the point. It's not even saying that they shouldn't be as popular as they are. The point is, because they're so popular and so clearly the only thing people are seeing in certain regions, that other kind of films are just no longer being made. But it seems like none of you out there want to actually engage with this conversation. So that's why we end up in the situation that we're in with him. I do want to say, though, I'm quite excited to see his movie. I don't know, it'll come out this month. I don't know how big of a player it's going to be when it comes to awards. I for sure will get nominations. But I would say, as hopeful as I was for Spielberg to win some awards last year for Fablemans, I'm as excited for him to get something for this movie, because it certainly does seem to be the culmination of a bunch of themes and just ideas in his mind that he's been leaning towards for quite some time. I'm actually going to play this clip from Gold Derby that I feel speaks to this. Let me go ahead. Yeah, it's... Yeah, here it is.
Killers of the Flower Moon, I don't think it's the type of movie he would necessarily win for. And I don't think, I think if it ends up being, this is not, if it ends up being, his last major movie, I think there's a lot of, it's a movie I'll definitely think about a ton, and it feels like it'll have a long life outside of award season, but I'm not sure it's the type of movie that he would win for now.
I think people want him to win.
I think they do. But I just think that Nolan and Oppenheimer is going to be too tough.
Yeah, like, I think it's, I mean, they're such different films, so it's really hard to compare them. And yeah, Killers of the Flower Moon is such a, it's a great Marty flick, because, like, he, there are, you know, elements of, like, a lot of his old stuff.
Yes, it feels, too,
you know?
It does feel like that. And yeah. I think if you view it as, like, whether or not it, like, it's like kind of like Fablemans. It's not like Fablemans at all, but you know what I mean? Like, remember how
Fablemans. It's not his childhood.
No, but remember how, like, Fablemans was like, oh man, if that, like, Spielberg had to be like, I'm not retiring, even though it felt like the summation of everything.
Yeah, it's like, I'm just gonna put all my, like, greatest hits in here,
and
basically.
I think that's what Killers of the Flower Moon is, and not just in style, but I think in themes, and a lot of the themes that Scorsese has kind of, like, talked, like, done movies about again and again, are very apparent here. And those themes, plus with the vantage point of being much older, and, like, obviously someone who is, like, even just now, like, before the, like, Robbie Robertson died, and, like, one of Martin Scorsese's best friends, and he talked about how sad it is, like, when people that close to you just are not there anymore. So I think, like, he's got, like, a great viewpoint of the movie, but I just don't think it's going to be, like, enough to beat Nolan for Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I think, like, Oppenheimer is more, like, of an obvious technical achievement, too.
Yes.
You know, not that Killers is not, but, and I do like the ending of Killers a lot. It's a big swing.
I love the ending, and I think it's, like, something people will really be talking about a lot.
Yes. It's already been spoiled in one of the reviews out of Cannes, and people got very mad about that.
Yeah, both those reviews that were spoiled have, like, now spoiler warnings on top. It's really funny. I went back and looked at them. I also think if Nolan doesn't win, he'll never win. This is like, then he'll never get enough. And then he'll just be, he's the guy who's not going to win and get like an honorary Oscar at some point. Because if this, he can't win for Oppenheimer, it's hard to imagine him winning for anything.
Yeah, I think it just ultimately depends on, like, which film, like, they feel more passionately about.
Right.
Like, in the end, like, is it Oppenheimer or Killers of the Flower Moon? Like, I can see Killers being more the respected but not loved film.
Exactly. This is
so, and I think also, like, we've seen a past decade in this category, like, they've been giving wins to mostly to people who've never won before.
Yes.
Like, obviously you have Iñárritu and Cuarón winning again, but
Del Toro,
like the Daniels,
like, Jane Campion. I mean, I think Nolan is more like Del Toro or Jane Campion.
Yes, obviously, like, he's a veteran, but yeah, it's, you know, like, they're not afraid to go to someone who has not won over a legend who maybe should have another Oscar.
Right.
So, I think that's a pretty good summation of, like, where things stand, but no matter what it ends up doing, the most important thing is how good the movie is or not, and I'm certainly very much looking forward to it. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at. I think that might be the next movie we'll be talking about on the show, so stay tuned for all of that. We have our final Ahsoka reaction, and of course, I mean, you can't miss that. Anyway, thank you all for being here. I've been Alexis Soto on Red Spotlight. Stay under our spotlight for more content and more podcasts every single Sunday, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.